Please be seated.
Ms. Becky Gannon.
Thank you, ma'am. moving on to, staying with the non-complying direction. And I'm just looking at your evidence in chief on page 7. And you took us through where there was broad agreement on a number of key points between some of the submitters, and you summarised that. In particular, looking at the second bullet on page 7, policy wording should be as certain as possible, may involve a mix of quantitative requirements and qualitative policies. And also the second last bullet point about requiring sound understanding of catchment hydrology and flow statistics, and that the policy framework should preferably reflect this, as well as the reference to a natural flow regime. So, bearing that in mind, as you'll be familiar, Fish and Game is proposing a table based on Dr. Hayes' recommendations of alteration to minimum flow and allocation rates with reference to naturalised mouth. It started in response to the use of the words no more than minor in the policy as notified. And as Mr. Farrell has now recommended it, in response to Mr. De Pelsmaker's drafting changes, it's referenced in the context of where under the Act a no more than minor assessment will be required either for notification or for the alternative non-complying gateway test. So have you got Mr. Farrell's supplementary evidence there?
I do.
This is the version.
The latest version.
The big version. So if you can hold mine's upside down, that's helpful. The proposed policy wording to encapsulate that reference is labelled, it's in blue and it's 10A24. And requires that where those flow minimum flow or allocation thresholds are breached, that it's a signpost, there will be an actual or potential more than minor adverse effect on ecological health. So it's specific to ecological health. And it directs that unless there is a comprehensive hydrological and ecological assessment that demonstrates otherwise. Now, in terms of that early agreement in principle that some quantitative requirements would help with providing certainty at the policy level. Do you agree that using that quantitative table in this revised context is of assistance?
I think I agree with the principle or the intent, with a caveat that I don't have the technical expertise to know whether those flow triggers, limits, points, whether this is the appropriate use of them. And I'm also, again, in that tension between how simple, clear pathway we can get versus how much we try to add in. So I support the intent or the principle, and the more that the plan change can put plan users in the case of having a clear understanding of what the plan is going to trigger, what their requirements are going to be, I support, but I would, I'm not in a position to say I support that wording as laid out there. That would be beyond my expertise technically, and I would withhold judgment to a certain extent as we go through the iterations that we're going through, where we land with what the objective of the plan change is, and then driven by that, how simple or otherwise the actual provisions need to be.
But in terms of the actual flow thresholds, you'd defer to the ecologists about whether or not they're an appropriate signpost when comprehensive assessments are required.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Then moving on again, and you would have you heard my cross-examination yesterday of Mr. Ensor about the restricted discretionary new water takes under Rule 12.1.4.6. Were you present for that?
I was.
So just for the record, Rule 12.1.4.6 provides that applications for new primary allocation in non-Schedule 2A catchments is a restricted discretionary activity. And at the moment, Plan Change 7 Policy 10A22 makes it, you know, directs that such consents from now on be no more than 6 years in duration.
Yes.
Do you see a risk that there's a potential loophole that could be misused by opting for a restricted discretionary new take rather than what would otherwise be a non-complying replacement consent under PC7?
I think that is a risk. It's the directiveness of that no more than 6 year policy probably lessens the risk, because if you go down that pathway, that's a very directive policy that you're going to, you know, have to contend with.
Yeah.
So I think it's a low risk, but it is a risk, and I also think it depends on, again, how the non-complying pathway is structured and what the policy framework that an application would be assessed against is for that. And I would think that if you get that right, then it should create the incentives for people to go down whichever is the more appropriate pathway.
Okay. Do you also think that that risk would be mitigated if it was non-complying to take new water for more than 6 years?
That, to me, would seem what is consistent with the rest of the plan change. So, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mum. No further questions.
Thank you. We have noted cross-examination from Forrest and Bird, no appearance, and Trustpower has advised the registry that it no longer seeks to ask any questions. So over to you, Ms. Irving or Mr. Page, for Oran.
Just before I forget, the last exchange you had with Ms. Baker-Galloway, is it your view that whether a consent is likely to be obtained under the restricted discretionary rule under the operative plan rule status for new water or through the non-complying status under Plan Change 7 is really more to do with what the policies say than what the activity status is?
Not entirely, because the non-compliant activity currently, if the two doors are just about shut,
yes,
then that does create quite a different circumstance to the restricted discretionary activity. If the policy settings were more as we've been discussing, then I think they would line up more. And certainly my preference would be that regardless of which entry point, it should be the same policies that an application is being assessed against.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Now, I'm going to move to a topic that you were asked questions about by the court at the start, and that is what the objective is. And the document that I'm going to have in front of me is your 23 March 2021 edition. And I'm also going to ask you to look at the National Policy Statement Freshwater Management 2020. So I wonder if you have a copy of that available to you at the same time.
I'm not go anywhere.
You wouldn't go anywhere without it?
No, fair enough. So, if we look at the objective, we can see using your track changing, enable transition towards the long-term sustainable management of fresh water in the Otago region. Is fresh water a defined term in the Act?
Fresh water?
Yes.
I don't believe so.
Ah. All right. Well, let me just read it to you then. The definition of fresh water in the Resource Management Act means all water except coastal water and geothermal water. Does that ring a bell?
Yes.
Okay. And so would your expectation be that the objective, when it uses a term that's defined in the Act, would have the same meaning?
That would be the expectation.
Yes. And so fresh water refers to the substance itself as opposed to the ecosystems it supports. Would you agree?
In terms of what the definition
of fresh
water? In terms of
what the objective is referring to there?
Yes.
Yes. Well, now, can we come to the NPS? And I wonder if you could have the objective open, which is page 9 of the document, Common Bundle 673. Do you have that?
2.1.
2.1, yes. And can you observe the first priority, 2.1A, in the terms used there? First, the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems. You see that?
Yes.
The terms used there, do you regard that as recognising the interconnectedness between freshwater and the ecosystems supported by freshwater?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Now, my understanding of the department's concern about Plan Change 7 is that there are aspects of freshwater ecosystems which are not adequately addressed in Plan Change 7. Is that a fair summary?
Yep, yep.
And particularly Otago species of galaxids?
Yes.
And is it your view that if freshwater ecosystems are not enabled to transition towards long-term sustainable management, that that wouldn't be a fair reflection of Tier 1 of Objective 2.1A of the NPS?
If they are not enabled to transition. So are you saying there that they would be left in their current state?
Well, the words of the objective say, enable a transition toward the long-term sustainable management of fresh water. In order to reflect the NPS, shouldn't the objective also include the ecosystems supported by fresh water?
I would agree with that. My reading of that objective is that the intention is that by managing the fresh water, you would be managing it for, among other, the purposes of maintaining freshwater ecosystems and protected species and doing those things. So you're managing the resource for the outcome, which is around ecosystems. The problem being, as I suspect you're leading towards, that the objective doesn't make that connection.
Yes.
And is it the department's or the Director General's concern is that simply maintaining or holding the line is an inadequate way of prioritising the needs of Galaxis?
My concern would be twofold. One is that holding the line, retaining the pattern, doesn't work if there are changes to flow regimes as a result of the non-replacement of the priority system. And secondly, that by holding the current management of the freshwater resource, if you like, we know that there are adverse effects, there are species in decline. So by holding that for 6 years, even if we resolve the risk around deemed permit priorities, you are accepting that over the course of that 6 years, there may be or will be some loss of values because the current state is not maintaining those values.
Yes. And we got a sense of that from Mr. Hickey, didn't we, that the current state is actually quite dynamic.
Yes.
And there are current threats to populations of Galaxid that may not be sustained by the status quo legal environment. Is that your understanding?
Yeah.
So is it your view that the NPS is actually telling us to intervene and do something about that?
Yes, and I go back, I guess, that was stated in my evidence, my supplementary evidence, and in the summary as I talked earlier, that it remains the case, I believe, that to the extent that this plan change can give effect to the NPSFM, it should, but that is being balanced against what is the best way to give effect in the long term.
Yes. So if the objective was to acknowledge the importance of freshwater ecosystems explicitly, then you might expect policies to flow from that which deal with the kinds of concerns that the Director General holds about Plan Change 7, mightn't you?
Yep, I would agree with that.
Yeah. And that might then lead to methods which enable enhancements to ecosystems and habitat for ecosystems to be made during the currency of Plan Change 7.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's really what Ms. Dicey's discretionary activity rule is about, isn't it? Is to enable applications to come forward that could deliver those kinds of enhancements.
That is my understanding of it,
yes. And do you have a difficulty with that?
It has to be balanced against that. What's the best overall outcome in the long term?
Yes.
So you wouldn't want it to be a pathway to make some, if you like, some small improvements now that lock that in for the long term against potentially better improvements in the longer term. But that, again, comes down to having an objective and policy framework that lets you make well-informed decisions.
Yes. Okay. But is your concern about locking in an outcome for the longer term that mightn't be as good as what the Land and Water Regional Plan anticipates, is that really centred on the efficacy of the Section 128 review process?
I think that's part of it. So to what extent could the same improvements be achieved through review as opposed to replacement of consent? But I'm also aware that a A new plan could include other provisions, other methods, non-regulatory measures, etc., that don't necessarily sit neatly within that review process. So even if the reviews sort of gave full ability to rewrite consents, I don't think that's a complete way of protecting that future improvement.
But I had taken from your evidence in chief an acknowledgement that the primary way that one provides protection for galaxid habitat is through imposing systems of minimum and residual flows on catchment, on water bodies where galaxids are present. Was that your view?
That is correct within the frame of Plan Change 7 and what it deals with. Stepping wider, then issues of fish passage, trout access, habitat quality, water temperature. There's a whole range of other things that, that come into play.
So with those examples that you've just given us, the non-regulatory methods that you had in mind in the answer to my previous question?
Partly, but I mean, there are also things that can be addressed in other ways through consents. We'd hope that the land and water framework, for example, would address water quality.
Yes. If the department has in mind that non-regulatory methods might be deployed to address galaxid habitat, how would granting consent that might impose at least interim minimum and residual flow limits on consents cut across that?
I don't think it would cut across it. The question would be, what does it lock in terms of abstractions and the land use that hangs off that abstraction? So part of my concern there is a discussion that's been had previously about Otago not having an integrated planning framework.
Yes.
And my understanding of the intention of moving to a land and water plan is to integrate that. So that will be one of the risks that consents that are granted now under a very freshwater resource centric approach without thinking about how they fit into, for example, what the impacts of those land uses are on other values, downstream flows resulting from those land uses, and so on. So those are things that I think probably fall to the plan change to address rather than being able to be fully addressed just through a review.
Yeah. If the Land and Water Regional Plan brought in requirements for consents to be obtained for land use that has an effect on fresh water, doesn't Section 20A of the Act require the applicant to then apply for consent?
Yes, and that would depend on how the plan was structured.
Yeah. So if a land and water regional plan were to introduce rules that required a consent to be obtained, how would granting consent now lock in a particular form of land use that had an effect on fresh water? Wouldn't that still be something that's available for the council to manage through its methods?
I think it's a lot less likely that a future plan change would
unwind existing land use at the time the plan change comes in, it's much easier to manage change from that point. So the risk is that by granting consents now that enable land use, and again it's probably more about change than continuation of the existing,
yes,
that without prejudging what the land and water plan will do, winding that back becomes quite difficult.
Were an application to bring forward a proposal that achieved substantial enhancement or protection of Galaxid habitat that involved investment in new infrastructure to make that happen, do you agree that that's unlikely to be feasible over a six-year permit term?
It would depend on the nature of the activity and the investment required, but I can easily envisage the situations where 6 years would not be an adequate term for the investment.
I mean, the Lindis proposal is an example, isn't it? Because the proposal was to retire the existing race network and use hydraulically connected in-ground gallery takes as a substitute, wasn't it? And at that kind of investment, you wouldn't expect to be feasible over a six-year permit term.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. And so there's a danger that those kinds of enhancements might be lost if they can't have access to longer-term permits.
Yes, and that would go to my concern, generally speaking, that currently it appears that the 104D gateways, sort of both gateways, are pretty much shut.
Yes.
While any application like that would, I think, have a reasonably high hurdle to pass, particularly in terms of needing to be assessed against Te Manawatu Wai, currently, I don't think there's really any reasonable way that they could make the case. And I would agree that there may be times when it is reasonable to allow that case to be made and then judged on its merits.
Yes. And wouldn't shifting from a non-complying activity status to a discretionary activity status enable that kind of merits-based assessment to occur?
I have turned my mind to that somewhat considerably in looking at this plan change. I believe that a discretionary activity is likely to be entirely appropriate in the land and water plan. I have concern that under the current regional plan water, the policy framework is not fit for purpose for discretionary activity decision making, where you don't have a presumption either way about whether to grant or not grant, and you're then very dependent on the policy framework for those decisions. So that is my reason for preferring a better structured non-compliant pathway, because it does at least get you around some of those gaps in the current plan, and it creates, as a non-compliant activity, it is for the application to make the case that it should be granted, which, if we're going to have an exception to the six-year term and the reasons for that, I think is appropriate.
Okay. So just to be sure I understand, your concern about the discretionary activity status and a pathway designed around that is concerned with the policy framework and the operative plan. But if the discretionary pathway was available through Plan Change 7, such as Ms. Dicey has suggested, then a policy framework could be devised to support that might overcome your concerns?
It could be. but I have doubts that that would be practical or achievable in the time frame that we have remaining.
All right. And as the objective 10A11 is currently drafted, we don't have a freshwater ecosystem and objective that forms part of that.
No, we don't.
But if we did, that would present an opportunity to establish a policy framework to support ecological enhancement.
It would, but again, and if I had a magic wand, bringing in a policy framework through Plan Change 7 that addresses all the gaps and failings in the current regional plan water would be my ideal. But I just don't think that's practical in the time that we have available.
Right.
It's also that decision between, do you put the effort there or do you put the effort into the land and water plan and the substantive document?
But the problem is that if we don't apply effort to that end, don't we miss the opportunity to impose minimum and residual flows on those waterways that are home to galaxid populations?
Yes, and that's the risk that I've outlined.
Yeah. Okay. Nothing further, Mark.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Williams, any re-examination? No. No, you're good, Ms. Irving? Yep.
Any questions or... No, I have no re-examination.
All right, thank you. Commissioner Edmonds.
I just wanted to explore a little your proposition in terms of the non-complying status and what you might or might not be able to test it against. And at one point you suggested that perhaps a suitable test might be not undermining an NPSFM compliant framework, future framework?
Yes, in my mind, I think that's the intent to work to. My wording in terms of enabling a transition is a step towards that, but as I've said, I don't know that that's the my final word in terms of what that drafting should say.
So perhaps we could explore that a little.
Yep.
So in terms of a transition, you've qualified that talking about the long-term management. Is that right? It's a transition towards the long-term sustainable management.
Yep, and that's
got two dimensions to it. So perhaps we could explore what you mean by long-term.
I should note that that's wording that comes from Mr. DePelsmaker's March 14 text. So I can give my view of how it would work. But
I'm not the author of that wording.
But I'm not the author of that wording.
Sure. So if you're applying this objective as perhaps being the only guidance that we have in the current draft, so what would you be thinking about in terms of the long-term sustainable management of fresh water? Would you have some sort of time period in mind?
I think implicit in that and the reference to the supply and to consents up to 31 December 2025 and the reference to until a new land and water regional plan is made operative, I think the timing is to have that framework in place within a six-year-ish term, but I don't think that spells out when we would actually achieve sustainable long-term sustainable management, because simply having the framework a plan change or a new plan becoming an operative, there's then a period that you have to work through as consents are replaced, new consents are granted, where they're brought into line with that new framework. So you potentially, and I think that's one of the drivers for this plan change, is that even if the new framework came in say 2025, that if you've got long-term consents, it could be another 20, 30 years before that framework bites through those consents.
So the MPS Freshwater allows you to think about stepped progress, if you like.
And to set points along the way and timelines.
So I guess my question is then, if you're thinking about something like not undermining future MPS FM compliant framework, how would you factor in those sort of considerations in terms of possible steps along the way, timeframes?
I think the difficulty is that we don't know what the Land and Water Plan is going to say in terms of its attributes, targets, timeframes. I don't know that we're in a position to be able to put markers against those longer-term points. But we are able to say, if we're looking at a new Land and Water Plan coming in from 2025 that does that, then what can we do between now and then that doesn't fetter its ability to set targets, limits, timeframes?
So how would you think about that in terms of somebody coming along with a non-complying activity, which on the face of it, no doubt, various benefits get advanced. Galaxis may be only one thing. There may be a whole range of other things, including perhaps other ecosystem considerations, broader considerations. How then would you evaluate that in terms of this MPSFM process, new document still to come, and whether it might stand in the way of achievement of that?
One concern I have with the current wording of that objective is that essentially the objective can be met by establishing a interim planning framework. That is not an environmental outcome. That's simply establishing a plan or a plan change, and that doesn't give you any indication of what that is achieving or not for the environment. So I consider that if instead of just saying by establishing an interim planning framework, there needs to be some text around there about what that is achieving in that interim. And we've had the discussion this morning, which has been helpful for me, around that. We're seeking to, I think we've moved on from holding the line, but maintain that pattern, maintain the existing environment to the extent that we can both measure it and manage it. I'm still struggling in my head to turn that into neatly crafted words, but I think there needs to be something in there where it's not just a case of you've completed a plan change, the objective is met, but the plan change and consents granted under it are achieving no worsening of the existing environmental regime during that six-year period.
No worsening. How would you apply that?
Well, yeah.
There are degrees of these things, aren't there?
It is, and I guess if we take that maintaining the current pattern systems, ecosystems, and we know that that's a slippery thing because things are in constant change, but it's how to pull that concept through, and so whether you say maintaining or not worsening, it's essentially that how to ensure that we don't go backwards environmentally during the term of or the life of this plan change. That's, I think, it's implicit in the thinking behind the current objective, but it's not explicit. And if you were assessing an application against it, I don't know that the objective is currently worded is going to drive that in a decision. So that is where my thinking around enabling a transition, but as we're discussing now, it's not just enabling the plan change to be made, but it's enabling the plan change to be implemented and consents granted in a way which doesn't undermine that future framework.
So you'd see that then as following through to non-complying applications consideration?
Yes, and then with a non-complying application, you've then got something to assess that against. Is this going to make things worse in the interim, or is it going to undermine the ability of that new framework to come in? The problem that I still have is turning that broad concept into some tight language for an objective. And that's where, as I note, a number of my planning comrades have also suggested wording. And that's been supplementary evidence, so I've reviewed those but haven't had sort of the chance to have a deep think about them. I would like to think that there was wording in there, but I'm not in a position yet to table something and say the intent of this is to not undermine the future framework, and here's some wording that does that.
So several of your colleagues have offered timeframes or durations for permits that might be suitable for non-complying activity treatment or discretionary activity treatment, I think, in the case of Oro. So do you have any comment to make about that?
In general terms, I think that's a valid approach and can be quite useful. But again, in the context of a short-term, you know, essentially a patch-up plan change, rather than having the ability to do what the fresh, you know, land and water plan should look like, and without having the, you know, full understanding of Te Manawa Te Wai and engagement with communities, and I think there are challenges to getting that policy to where you would really like it to be. And I guess I come back to that risk management approach. I don't think that through this plan change we can get an objective and policy that would endure for the long term. So what can we do that best manages the risk between now and, call it, 6 years' time?
So you're in support of 6 years, but you think 35 years should be on the table. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, for
a non-compliant activity.
And I'm comfortable with the concept that 6 years should be the default and the expectation under the plan, and any application that's for longer than that, that is a non-compliant activity and it needs to make the case as to why it should get through. My problem is that we don't have a policy framework to make that assessment yet. I also note that there have been other proposals of timeframes for either non-compliant pathways, Mr. Ensor, his drafting that was discussed yesterday, and also for discretionary pathway. I'm not opposed to that, but if we're trying to get the plan change as simple as we can, then in some ways 6 years or as a non-compliant activity make your case it could be anything, depending on the merits. It's probably the simplest way of resolving that.
So I think one of Mr. Pausenmaker's answer early on in relation to questioning was he had a concern about perhaps some of these date-setting targets for applications. Would you hold a similar view on that?
I would share that concern in the sense that we're not in a position to have a fully resolved new plan. So any dates that we set now are going to be, essentially the best we can do under the framework. I think there's a limit to how detailed we can get about that before we reach the point where we might as well just start doing the new plan. My ideal situation would be that we could do something that was finally crafted like that, but I don't think we're in that position to manage the risk over the next 6 years. I do support the concept of a six-year time frame and a non-compliant pathway for anything outside that.
So the six-year time frame you're referring to is not... there's the need to get the new plan up and running.
Yes, yes.
But beyond that period, there's a whole big reconsenting exercise to go on,
yes.
Isn't there?
Yeah, and that's the point when the plan really takes effect, as consents roll through and get brought into line with the new plan framework.
So how many years do you think that might take?
That depends on the plan and it depends on the duration of consents granted prior to the plan. And as we know, there are a reasonable number of water takes that have been granted in the last few years for 25 years or longer. So we're potentially looking at them still being in place for 20 years odd after the new plan comes into place.
So presumably the regional council would have to make some calls about what are the priority areas to advance under any review section 128 review process to bring everyone in the tent?
Yes, they would. And I think the comments we've had so far are essentially that the catchment reviews that have been made in terms of minimum flows have been in the catchments where water is not short and there's not tight competition. The regional council is going to have to, and I would hope through the land and water plan, set some frameworks to roll through the rest of the catchments and bring them into line, and that should be a environmentally based framework. And I should make the comment again that when I worked at the regional council in the late 90s, I was involved in consenting but was also involved in having input into plan, and that was certainly the understanding of how the plan was intended to work, that by the time we got to now, the regional council would have rolled through on a catchment basis, would have developed minimum flows, would have done catchment-wide reviews, and they would all be in place so that we would have that framework. Now that hasn't happened, but I think that remains a need, and the new plan will need to have a framework for that.
So you're not prepared to take a stab as to how long it might take when after the new plan comes on to basically get all these catchments inside of the tent?
Subject to
the new regime?
Yeah, I mean, it would certainly be years simply to go for, and I haven't read the full detail of Ms. Everett Hinks, I think's evidence on the scientific work that the Regional Council is doing, but there is considerable scientific work that needs to be done. There is considerable community engagement processes that needs to be done. So for any catchment, you're talking some years to go through a flow setting and then a consent review process. There are multiple catchments to do that, so we're talking years. I would probably pick 10 to 20 years to go through that process.
So
but hopefully you would do that having looked first at what are the most important areas to make those changes in. And so instead of starting with the catchments where there is currently a little competition for water and not a lot of need for a minimum flow, that process would start with the ones where there are the greatest environmental gains to be made and work through those over the course of however many years it takes, but start with the important ones.
So I just have one remaining question, and Mr. Page did ask you about DOC and the use of non-regulatory methods, so I just wanted to understand from you one, what non-regulatory methods might be available in terms of galaxid protection, and secondly, whether there's anything in this plan change that would prevent those non-regulatory methods from being effective.
I would first note that this is not my area of expertise, so I can talk about the things that I have encountered or seen, but I wouldn't hold myself out as an expert in that area. But it certainly involves one of the critical ones is trout don't get on well with Galaxis species, or certainly the non-diadromous Galaxis.
They get on perfectly well, that's the problem.
well, from the trout's perspective, yes.
Yes.
And so management of trout, and one of the issues there is around Otago, there are a number of places where there are currently barriers to fish passage, which would normally not be a good thing, but in this case they are keeping trout out. So as a minimum, I guess, is DOC works with landowners both through the consent process and outside the consent process to ensure that existing barriers such as perched culverts, they can be man-made such as perched culverts or natural such as steep rocky sections are maintained. There's also work underway to introduce new barriers artificially, and potentially then to remove trout from the section upstream of that to allow the Galaxis species to colonise or for the population to increase in those areas. Habitat enhancements is obviously one of the key things, spawning enhancement. So there's a lot of those activities that go on. I haven't seen anything in Plan Change 7 that would cut across that, other than there may be activities that I'm not aware of where water rights are needed and that consent term could be an issue. But that is something that I couldn't give an instance of that. It's just something I'd be cautious that that situation could potentially arise.
Thank you.
All right. A little bit more from me again on objective, on the objective one. And just again trying to dig in and understand your thinking around this objective. I know that this is not your language. Nevertheless, you made a submission, the department made a submission on the objective and could have, under the submission, amended the objective in some manner, but you haven't, save to the extent that you recommend enabling a transition to a long-term sustainable management of fresh water. And in that context, in answer to one of the questions to Commissioner Edmonds, you were saying you are hoping that under this objective, the best you can do is manage your risk for a period of 6 years. Or manage the risks for a period of 6 years.
Yeah, or not necessarily 6 years, but I guess until the new land and water plan comes into place and starts being effective.
Okay.
And I guess we're assuming 6 years for that, but that may be a placeholder.
That may not be right. But assuming that, well, it's for 6 years or until the land and water plan, the new land and water plan becomes operative. And so I was thinking about that. You know, what are the risks that you are talking about? And it seemed to me that on the wording of the objective, it is a risk to the planning framework in some way. Would that be fair? The framework to come, the new plan to come. As currently worded, this is what
As currently worded, yes.
Yeah. So it's currently worded, this objective sets out not to undermine that new, in some way, that new land and water plan to come.
Yeah.
Correct. Okay. And at a very broad scale, I thought an NPS compliant land and water plan might look like something where the values and outcomes for those values are identified.
Yes.
Yep. And then target attributes and attribute states are also identified.
Yes.
And limits pertaining to the attainment of those attribute states are identified.
Yes.
And timeframes for doing this are also identified and settled.
Yes.
And that broadly is an NPS compliant plan. And as I understand it, the timeframes allow for a step transition into something which moves us towards looking at the attainment of Te Mana O Te Wai. And in, just bear with me. And Te Mana O Te Wai, including the objective four. Now, let's replace the three-tiered objectives, which are set out where? And I've lost my place. Down here we go. Three-tiered objective, which is set out in objective or clause 2.1. You could have stages over time where limits are imposed to reach attribute states, and those attribute states may vary over time to the ultimate goal, which is attaining that objective. Is that how this works?
I mean that's my understanding. It is how some plans elsewhere are already structured, and it is what I would expect an NPSFM 2020 compliant plan to broadly look like, yes.
So when we talk about risking that future planning framework, and again accepting it's not your language, it's the plan change, is the risk there that the risk to that future planning framework is risk associated in changing an environment with consequential cumulative adverse effects, which means that the attribute states and timeframes for achieving those attribute states must also change as a consequence and be extended over a period in time. Is that the risk or is it something else?
I think I see the risk from two directions. One is if activities are allowed to continue or consents that are granted in that interim period before the new plan comes into place, if that allows environmental degradation, then that resets what the new plan can achieve. Mm. And the obvious example that concerns the Department of Conservation and its interests is around non-migratory galaxies. If a species goes extinct, then protecting that species in the new plan is no longer available.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, it's the what happens between now and then is one element. The other element is what is locked in consents granted between now and then that will continue to apply after the plan comes into effect. And that could either risk loss to the environment, which limits what the plan change, the new plan can achieve, but it also risks pushing out the timeframes in which the plan change, or the new plan, sorry, can achieve them, so that when you're creating that new plan, you wind up constrained in what you can achieve because of what's happened in the years before. That would be, I can't speak for the Regional Council in preparing it, but that would be my understanding of the two key risks to a future framework.
And the underlying assumptions are that the environment is, or some part of the environment is degraded or degrading now, and that those processes will continue, and not necessarily at a steady state, but as with everything to do with the environment, interacting with other inputs, both natural and non-natural. So that's the first part.
Yes, and also a risk that there may be changes or degradation not currently in play, but which could come into play between now and the new plan coming into force.
And that is a consequence. Those additive changes can be a consequence of consenting new applications.
Yes.
But it could also be a consequence of something natural happening within the environment as well.
It could be in the environment, changes in technology.
And so in this, okay. Did you just say as a consequence of environment, but also as a consequence in technological change?
Well, technological changes, changes in the way people use and manage their land, changes in the climate. Yeah, so there could be a range of other factors.
And where those changes are anthropocentric, so it's not not the natural environment creating an additive change. Some of those changes, I understand, are not changes which are managed nor necessarily visible to this regional council. And that would include technological change.
Yes.
Inducing a new state of environment with consequential or cumulative effects. Yeah, okay.
Yes, yep.
All right. So, with that in mind, we're an applicant who put up an application that says, look, I am working on managing the risk associated with part of the environment. I've heard a lot about galaxids, but I am sure galaxids are not the only creature in the environment. But if a proposal is put up to work on galaxids and managing the risk to galaxids, why would the applicant not be able to say under the current language of this objective that enables a transition to a long-term planning framework? It seems to me an applicant could say exactly that, whereas the risks that you're talking about aren't necessarily captured in that iteration.
Yes, and my intent in the wording is that an applicant doing something like that would be able to, if you like, gain the benefit from that wording, if that is what they're doing. The difficulty is that enhancing things for galaxids may not be all that they're doing. And I think the sort of thing that is being envisaged is where applicants are wanting to continue with their abstraction and irrigation operation, and as part of that do it in a way which improves things for galaxids, but that's not the driver for it. And in that case, you would still need to be able to weigh up what are the benefits that are accruing versus what are the environmental costs which are also accruing and potentially locked in if it's a longer term consent.
You see,
so it's not going to be binary.
No, it's not going to be binary, but it's if your concern is not changing the if your twofold concern is managing risks associated with a degraded or degrading environment, whatever that means, because that'll be different spatially across the region. So that's the first concern, managing that. Second concern is not to allow additive effects into the environment, which then would defer gains to be made under a future land and management plan because the environment's changed, and so the attribute states over time frames would be pushed out or not able to be attained at all. I don't hear any of that in what you've just said. I would have thought it would be easy peasy for anybody under this objective to come along and say, look, we're working on one problem of the environment and that is all that we're required to be working on, because it doesn't undermine a future plan, because you haven't got a clue what's in the future plan and what the community might want to be, you know, putting in a future plan. I can't see how this objective gets us anywhere, even with your changed wording. It just doesn't, does it? I mean, it might push out for another day or another decade what attribute states the communities say should be the outcome for the values that they identify, provided that you haven't had any other species extinction in the meantime. Those outcomes could be obtainable.
Yep. I agree, and I think partly it's about that issue of, is this an objective or a method, and going back to the DG's original submission, which was to have an objective which is an environmental outcome objective, and then an interim planning framework is a method to achieve that environmental outcome, and that environmental outcome is probably the maintaining patterns, not degrading ecosystems, losing species,
until we have risk.
Until we have a new plan change in place. And an interim planning framework is a method for achieving that.
Now, if you have an interim planning, if you have a new planning framework which identifies the target attributes and over certain time frames, we've heard discussion or cross-examination about there being a discussion RPS out in circulation which might include a policy that resource consent shall be not longer than 20 years. Now, I don't know what that means, or even where we'll ever get to an RPS that looks like that. But the fact that there is a maximum term, if you like, of 20 years under an RPS or 35 years under the Act does not mean to say that the attribute states precludes the step change in the environment over time relating to those attribute states, which stepping might take you well beyond 20 years. Is that not so?
Yes, I'd agree with that. And I guess if you have a staged improvement in terms of the attribute states and a 20-year consent, then that 20-year consent needs to either be consistent with where those attribute states are going to be in 20 years' time, or the consent has a mechanism of decreasing contaminant loads over time, for example, in order to align with that.
But equally, even if there is a maximum term of 20 years, resource consents could and should be imposed for a lesser period of time where there is a staged approach being taken to the attribute states.
Absolutely, and I think I would just emphasise in my discussions on non-compliant pathway is that I would never see that as then being people can expect 35 years. That should still probably be at the rear end of the spectrum, and if it's a 20-year limit in the RPS, the same should apply, that should be the upper limit, but on its merits as to where it sits between 0 and 20.
Okay, as opposed to an assumption that if the plan says 20, you'll get 20.
Yes, yep.
Okay. All right. Okay, thank you.
No
questions. Anything arising from the court's questions? No questions. So thank you very much for your evidence. It's been very helpful.
Thank you.
You're looking at me because... do we go to Ms. McIntyre?
Well, just a question of when your Honour wants to take lunch. It's 12:45 in the schedule.
Yes.
It's 12:41 according to my...
Well, we won't crack on. We'll take lunch. How about that?
That suits me, Your Honour. Thank you.
Suits you? Very good. Okay, lunch then. Back at... What time does the schedule say we'll be back at? 2 or 1:30? 2.
Your choice, Your
Honour. That's right, I'm in control. You wrote the schedule, though. I don't know. What do you need? 2:00?
Well, I think Ms. McIntyre's the next witness, yep. I believe, Your Honour. 1:45 would be fine.
1:45?
An hour's ample time for lunch, I suspect.
Okay, very good. 1:45 it is then. Thank you.
All rise.